You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber.
And I'm Dave Fettig. And this evening I will be interviewing, in just a second, Gordon Henry, author of the book of poems White Clay, Red Exits, and Distant Others.
And in the second half of the hour, I will be, this is Liz Olds, by the way, I will be interviewing Kristen Johnson, a former host of Right on Radio from many years ago, who has written a book called Fearless about, it's a young adult book about a girl and a dog.
All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio. Hello, Gordon, are you there?
I'm here, yeah.
Okay, great.
Great. Hi, Gordon, this is Dave. Welcome
Hi,
to the
Dave,
program.
Hi, Dave,
I need some headphones. Hey, Gordon, I'm getting some headphones on right now, and then I can be able to hear you better. How does that sound? All right, here we go.
That sounds good.
Okay.
That sounds good.
Once again, welcome to the program, Right on Radio, and you come to us from Michigan via Holy Cow Press in Duluth. We love our local publishers, Minnesota publishers here at Right on Radio, and we especially like Holy Cow. So welcome again. And I tell you what, before we get started and have you do a reading, Gordon, could you tell us a little bit about your background as a writer and how you came to poetry?
Sure enough, yeah. Well, I started writing pretty early, I guess you could say. I was writing for quite a while, a long time, just after I got out of high school. I started writing just informally, though. I'd never had any training, and I didn't really show anything I'd written to anyone for about 7 years. So I was just sort of writing down a journal kind of notes and things. And I took a creative writing class when I was an undergraduate student at a school in Wisconsin. And then that sort of set the fire. I got a degree, actually an undergraduate degree in business management, but I knew I wanted to write.
Right.
And so I just continued with that degree, and I got into a few masters in creative writing programs, and decided to enroll at Michigan State since they offered me a fellowship based on a manuscript I submitted for entry into the master's program. So
cool.
That's sort of the background, but my family's from the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota for many generations back. I lived there briefly when I was growing up, and so Minnesota's sort of inside me from the stories of my family and from the times that I was there. I carry it in
wonderful.
Memories and also in the stories of my family.
And speaking of stories, you've written more than poetry. You've written very successfully some fiction, too.
Yep, I started out, actually, my first publications, though I published a few poems here and there, my first publication in the 1990s, The Light People, was a novel, a sort of experimental novel, which I used a lot of techniques of poetry to try to deliver a longer manuscript with internested stories. And that sort of got me off in writing, though I'd been writing poetry before that. So yeah, I've published fiction, scholarly essays, written short stories. So I branch out a bit. Even tried my hand at a little songwriting, though I haven't done anything very public with that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was going to ask you about music and your poetry, but before we get into your work, let's hear some of it. Do you have a poem in particular you'd like to start with this evening?
Sure, I could start with one from the new collection.
Course,
Spirit Matters, White Clay, Red Exits, Distant Others.
Yeah.
This is called Relative X, a white clay tabernacle of grief, of longing, unwrapped parcels of lost joy, survival school books, margins with poorly drawn broken hearts, empty mirrors, wash basin and rear view, useless timepieces worn down to a last hour, an interval less than a stop second. Tobacco ties, bowls of beads for unmade giveaway Thunderbirds, BIA check stubs, a glass ashtray your mother threw at some deer hunter's shadow of betrayal in the doorway, a hissing cassette recording of Ring of Fire, sung by the Army vet face on the drunk punch wall, who waved the gun at us last Christmas, then set fire to his own childhood regalia. There's an unblessed host in there, too. A book of matches from some white bar in Walker, Park Rapids, or Wadena. A poorly developed photo of a blonde from Anoka. A page lifted from the invisible musician. A baseball cup. A Kennedy half dollar from a confirmation sponsor. An illegible prescription for persistent pain. The dried white chrysanthemum wedding flower. A bullet from the pistol your aunt threw into the White Clay River after your grandfather died. A singer's drumstick from the drum with only one living singer left.
Thank you. That was Gordon Henry reading from Spirit Matters, Winter Clay, Red Exits, Distant Others. A great poem to begin with for a lot of reasons. Harks back to some time in your life, I believe. And Minnesota's in there, of course. And I tell you, this is a great example of the first question I was going to ask you, Gordon, which is your poems for me. I'm going to call them imagist, but I'm not a scholar because all I see are just beautifully described and detailed pictures after picture after picture. I just feel images. The words are perfect in that regard. And sort of an uneasiness, I'll just say, in terms of the structure. That is to say, you read this perfectly, but if I were to read this cold out loud, I might not know where to start or stop, where to take the breath, where the next idea begins, because your subject sometimes begins and ends at the end of a line. So reading that, you can't, nor you should. I'm talking too much now. Read these poems too fast. But you can't. You need to slow down, take the words in, and listen to you. So, hey, there's a question in there somewhere.
Yeah, I think you're right that I think my poetry can be characterized in a lot of ways as images poetry, which really relies on imagery, but perhaps as much on the juxtaposition of images as they create sort of new associations through that imagery. And so what you're saying about the way the poem looks on the page and the way that I read it, it does sort of speak to the idea that each image will lead to a line in a way that perhaps a regular speech patterns or thought patterns might not. Mm-hmm. So poetry allows us to explore the ways different phrasing. I'm gonna say that I'm sort of using phrases and the way that different phrases work with each other to build image upon image, and then thus create a sort of an effect or feeling or emotion, perhaps.
It's very powerful. Did you come to this? Did you develop this this sort of style of writing? When did it happen? How did it happen?
I'm not really sure. I think it's something that came pretty naturally to me when I started thinking about some of the images of my life, some of the things that I sort of fictionalized as images. You know, memory isn't always 100% reliable, or even sometimes 50%, depending on who you are, I guess. But just the idea that the memory can evoke some situation, even though it might be broadly cast as a kind of fictional memory. I think, you know, that's something I've always been engaged with. I mean, I've always been sort of taken by things I see, the tone of the images I see, the things that I hear, the way phrases come out. And so I think I try to work through that in writing. I think even my prose, my latest prose is very much like that as well. It's image based, and it really moves through these phrases and stages of phrasing.
There seem to be allusions to the past in this poem, to memory. To what degree, it may seem obvious that people might think poets look to their memory and their experiences all the time to write poems, but I'm not sure that's always the case. Tell us about what motivates this book, which, by the way, I'll note to readers, for a typical poetry book, it's a bit longer than most. Really has like three books in it, sections. White Clay, Red Exits, Distant Others, and which is wonderful. It's a great bonus. There's a lot of good work in here. How did this collection take shape?
Well, I started writing some of them quite a while ago, and I had these little, as my teacher used to say, suites of poems, you know, like parts of poems and things that I'd been thinking about for a long time. Some of them memory based, but also sort of built on just fragments of memory that expanded out into more like little micro stories, what I like to call sort of shadow boxes or shadow spheres of memory that create little smaller stories. When my editor first read this, he said, you know, at first he didn't quite connect with it. And then he said, well, I see you're kind of doing little stories with poetry in a way, too, sort of image stories. And so that was part of it. But as I kept writing, parts would come to me at different times, even when I was driving. I mean, I will admit that I typed some in my phone app on my text, a notes app, and then I
Oh, sure.
revised them once I put them on paper. But it came to me in these stages, and you're right, you're absolutely right about there's different books within it. I struggled with that. I actually cut out a lot of material as well and talked to another publisher before Holy Cow, who also wanted to publish it, but I wasn't feeling quite like I had the structure where I wanted it. So I try to organize it around the images of water and rivers as sort of being these separate things that separated different sections and then came back to the rivers. As part of the imagery of it, that sort of held it together thematically, I hope.
And I should note to listeners also, there's humor in here. There's all of life in here. There's one particular, oh gosh, I wrote it down. Gosh, Gordon, it is a poem about water and
Oh,
every word you can imagine. And I found myself smiling and openly chuckling a couple of times. It's an amazing sort of poem, and stretches the boundaries of the definition of poetry too, like a lot of good poetry does. So there's a lot going on here. We're almost midway point, Gordon. Let's listen to another poem.
Sure, I'll turn to one of those river poems that I mentioned.
Good.
If I'm trying to, I got a bunch of markings in my books for my reading tomorrow night. So,
Yeah, we want to mention that too.
I was trying to imagine what a river, you know, might say to us. That sounds kind of like a simplistic idea, but this poem is called "The River Tells, Sings to Us Sleeping." Fox on the right bank before willow. Low flying crow across ever flowing glisten of our many faces. Leaping autumn spawn. The language of strangers upstream. Something about a moon cast echo of a singer on a bridge. A canto of blown smoke. With a syntax of floating bodies and undisclosed submersible consonants. This is where you may swim. This is where you must not. A silent swirl here, a man and a woman on a red blanket embankment together, a woman looking into stiller water for a past among floating leaves. I have taken children, I have delivered relatives. Downstream from portages and dams, a mother with an offering to always, every day. Dear Lick Sunrise, we have accepted another small craft. Washed out bear tracks with the wake of a white canoe. Early moon at the bow, late sun stern. Tales of missing bodies and boats turned over, log rolling narratives, ice jam explosions, torches and spears. The lunge of brown fish, their sun-streamed variant color, the pull of line, a stone's throw splash, underwater gleam of small change. The entry of face wash hands, a skimmer's touch beneath a dragonfly circle, the sand full lens of a cannon caressed by fingers of weed, the hardness of protruding rock at heart stopping rapids, a tuber's beer can flying toward the two blue heron priested shore, a hand on a lantern drawing nearer to this voice, a child looking to cross an archipelago of stones. A wine-soaked teenage poet from the left bank, cursing loneliness. A leather notebook turning over in cedar leaf rapids, words illegible, a few unbound pages separating, a zodiac picture pouring star-tailed myths into all we witness. in slow, continuous passing.
Ladies and gentlemen, Gordon Henry reading from Spirit Matters, White Clay, Red Exits, Distant Others. We mentioned music briefly earlier, Gordon, and music came to mind as I was reading some of these poems, maybe rhythm. I'm not sure which it was, but it came to mind. And I was wondering if you were thinking about music or musical patterns when you were writing some of these, or were these formed as lyrics? I heard music here.
Yeah, I think that music, sort of this internalized music of poetry and the sound of words and the phrasing of words, has always been something I've been interested in. If I was a better musician, I probably would have been a songwriter second, a visual artist first, because I do like images and I do like the sounds of words and language. I think, what pushed me over the cliff to be a poet, if that's the right way to say it, is, I started listening to songwriters pretty young, and they influenced me to try to just, first I started writing with the patterns of songs I already knew and just filled in my own verses. Mm-hmm. And then I just started writing poetry and in the way that I do now, or, maybe something a little different back then, but moving toward what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an audience in mind, Gordon, when you write these poems?
That's a really difficult question. I like to think that I can't say that I do. Honestly, I think that when I write the poems, I just hope that somebody's reading, who's reading them, can make the connections with the words, with the images, with the sort of extended meanings and connotations of the images and phrases in ways that I try to when I read poetry. Mm-hmm. I think everybody will bring their own past, their own memories, their own ways of hearing and listening to poetry and reading it to a poem. And that's really what I strive for. I'm looking for, if there's an audience, a reader who's willing to work with the way that I write and think about the way that I'm bringing about imagery, to engage with the poetry in a way that might open something up for them. I can't really say that. I'm looking for a reader that's open, I guess. You know what I'm saying? That's open to the possibilities of what I might be putting out there.
Right. Native themes, if I may, if that's show up, obviously. Mm. And I'm a non-native reader myself. But there's so much in here. There's an element of mystery for me in that regard, because I don't know that world the way you know it. But to your previous point, and why I'm raising this, is these are poems that are open to readers. You ask for readers who are open to the poems. I think the poetry is open to the readers. And I think it's in large part description of nature. Nature is everyone's, right? And let's talk about nature in that respect, in terms of inspiration for you and how it grounds you, because it appears to ground you.
Yeah, I'll start sort of a digression from that question by mentioning that one of the things that did inspire me was there's an Anishinaabe author named Basil Johnston, who was a speaker of the Anishinaabe language and a storyteller and a scholar and a writer. And he once wrote a book called The Manadus, that he put out there, that talked about the spiritual beings of the Anishinaabe. And many of those spiritual beings had specific or particular kinds of relation to nature. And historically, a lot of people have spoken about Nanabuju as a sort of central figure of Anishinaabe mythology. But Basil Johnston also brought in others. And one of the ones he talked about was Chiabus, who was a unique kind of mythic figure, in that the way Johnston put it in his book was that Chiabus would remain still for long periods of time. And so people thought there was something wrong with him because he was so still. And I was engaged with that. And it turns out, in Johnston's interpretation, that Chiabus was trying to communicate with people who have passed on. And so it's in that stillness that I want to say that we pick up the things that sometimes poetry and imagery gives us, but also allows us to appreciate nature and all of the things that are going on when we're engaged or immersed, I guess is a better way of putting it, in that natural world. Mm-hmm. So that's one way that I tried to think about this book, is with Chabus as sort of a back character.
Oh, that's interesting. It sounds like you write all the time. You don't get up in the morning and work from 6 to 8 and then go off to teach. You're writing on the way to work and all the time. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm more sporadic. I know a lot of writers, especially people who write big books, fiction books, you know, they have a schedule. And I did that with my novel, but my life has been so rich and fulfilling in so many other ways. I do have to write all the time. I'm writing in my head. I'm putting things in my phone. I'm writing on my computer. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I would have to say you're right. I'm writing all the time. And if not writing, incubating. Even though I don't have a ton of books out there, I'm still always thinking about ways of turning things into writing art or some kind of images.
Sure. You're a teacher. Do you teach poetry?
I do. I'm going to be teaching a course in poetry at Dartmouth College in a few weeks. Wow. And I teach it at MSU. So, it's just one of the great gifts of my life to be able to do that and to talk about poetry with students and to get what, you know, they're picking up from poetry, too.
I think sometime I'd like to have someone like you spend a whole show talking about teaching writing and teaching poetry. It sounds difficult teaching someone to write poetry, but
it is in many ways. I think it's difficult, but it's part of, again, sort of being open and letting go of you know, what you think you might know, and just letting yourself free up there and think about things in specific ways and very specific things that might have happened, rather than, you know, big words that are more abstract, though those can work too sometimes.
Sure. I actually got the 2-minute warning, Gordon. I want to talk about what's happening tomorrow night. Can you tell us what's going on here?
Yeah, I have a reading at Bockley Gallery, sponsored by Birchbark Books. And I think about that reading, I want to recognize the artist who did the cover art for the book, Jim Denemy. It was a great honor to have him do the cover art. And so we'll be in that space where some of his work had been shown as well. And but yeah, it's tomorrow night, 7 p.m. I'll be there. There'll be books for sale. But, you know, and I think Hyde Erdrich is going to be conducting a little conversation back and forth.
Oh, she's great.
With me at the time.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. The cover is striking, by the way. It's a bonus. You're getting a nice big book of poems and a beautiful, beautiful cover, ladies and gentlemen. We have been speaking with Gordon Henry, author of current volume of poetry, Spirit Matters, White Clay, Red Exits, Distant Others, just out from Holy Cow Press up in Duluth. And Gordon will be speaking tomorrow evening. Thanks, Gordon. It's been a real treat.
Thank you, David. I appreciate you inviting me on, and I look forward to the reading tomorrow night, and keep up the good work with your show.
Awesome. Thank you, sir.
All right. Bye. Take care.
Yep.
Bye.
And now this.
Kristen, are you there?
Yes.
Oh,
can
great.
You hear me?
Yes, right. I can hear you. We're going to be speaking with Kristen F. Johnson, author of Fearless and a former host of Right on Radio, too. So welcome.
Thank you so much.
I am wondering if you happen to have a copy of the book with you and could do a brief reading for us.
I do, and I have something picked out.
Oh, great. Great. Go right ahead.
Okay, thanks, Liz. All right, this is just a little bit into the book after our main character meets a couple of friends and they are off riding their bikes in the St. Peter countryside, and I'll start there. The trees were thick, not like neighborhood trees that were evenly spaced out because they had been planned. These were more wild, leading in every direction and thick with leaves and underbrush. I wish I was wearing a camouflage hat with twigs and leaves sticking out of it and had green paint on my face. I wished I had a camo shirt like Oscar's, but at least my fearless t-shirt was a shade of green. It would have to do. Fallen branches and twigs snapped beneath my feet. I slowed my steps to silence them. An owl hooted from somewhere hidden in the maze of green above me. I thought owls were only out at night, Oscar whispered. Shh, I said. A bead of sweat formed on my forehead, traveled down my nose, and then hung off the tip. I shook it off. They are known to be nocturnal, Nikki said. Shut up, I whispered angrily. You shut up, Nikki said loudly. The sound of barking made us both shut up. I leaned forward, trying to determine the direction of the barking. Where was that coming from? It didn't sound like one dog. It sounded like a whole pack of dogs. I stepped forward again and the boys followed. My legs ached from my bike injuries, but I pressed onward. We sneaked around the grouping of trees and came upon a makeshift path, dirt and brush trampled by car tires. Inside that area, a clearing showed a tall, dilapidated red barn. It was old, with paint chips and boards missing. It leaned slightly to the left toward a smaller, equally weathered ranch house, with dirty paint, missing screens, and shingles hanging off the roof. In the back, I saw the hint of a small shed and the rusty red truck with piles of dog food bags in the back. Another rusted car was up on blocks in the yard with discarded tires sitting in the weeds. With the old trees, it created a creepy scene. Whoever had driven the truck was nowhere in sight. Country music played from a radio and sounded like it was coming from the house. Oscar motioned that we should turn back. I scowled at him and shook my head no. Nikki motioned that he had to pee. For Pete's sake, these two. I drew my hand across my neck in the universal signal to knock it off. I motioned us forward and pointed at the barn. Oscar gave me a right this instant motion to leave, but I shook my head no again. No way was I leaving without finding out what all that barking was about. I ran from the open area and went behind the barn. The boys followed. We were in this together, whether they liked it or not. We were all trespassers. As we got closer to the barn, it looked like a house of cards that could topple at any minute. The slats were far enough apart in places that you could see right through them. I pressed my face up against the boards and squinted like a pirate. It was dark inside. A large industrial fan whirred from one corner, which muffled the barking a little, but it was still evident, like a harsh choir of staccato notes. Through my peephole in the board, I could see someone going down the aisles and doing what? Maybe feeding the dogs from the sound of the tink, tink, tink of dry kibble landing in dog dishes. The fan whirring and the dogs barking, some whimpering, likely covered up any twig snapping noises we might be making. But still, I found myself on tiptoes, easing farther down that barn wall until I bumped into a handle. It was a back door.
That's Kristen Johnson reading from her book, Fearless, a Young Adult Book. And there are two through lines in this book. And the dog through line, let's do that one second, because I want to talk about the other through line first, which is about a daughter who has a mother deployed in Afghanistan. And I'm wondering I don't know if inspired is the right word, but what brought you to writing about that?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, Liz. And thanks for having me on Right on Radio tonight. What really inspired me was because I had started this book in 2007, and that was during the Iran and Afghanistan wars that were going on. And I just felt like I was so moved and kind of upset about what was going on that I really wanted to include a war through line in my book. And the way that this actually connected over with the dog is that I had a rescue dog also at the time, and she was rescued from an Indiana puppy mill and she was an older yellow Labrador who had PTSD from living at the puppy mill. And she would flinch every time I would move too quickly or even like move a piece of paper by her or come too close to her, and it would make her jump. And when she dreamed, as you know, dogs do, I wondered if her dreams were different than what we envision other dogs would dream about, such as chasing squirrels that a happy dog might dream about. And I wondered if she had nightmares instead about being at that puppy mill. So I wanted to make her nightmares go away. So I created this novel where the dog would get away from the puppy mill. And I also wanted the puppy mill owners to get what was due to them for mistreating the dogs. So basically I connected the fact that this dog I had PTSD and had gone through sort of a war by being in this puppy mill mm-hmm. to this war that was going on. And we get all these veterans back and they've gone through a war and they have PTSD. And that's why I kind of included both of those in the book. And then there's also this third thing with the town of St. Peter, which also went through a sort of war by being struck by all these tornadoes back in 1998. So they all just kind of converged together and sort of made their own little perfect storm.
And you also have a young man who has PTSD. Talk more about PTSD. Did you do a lot of research about that, or are you familiar with it through a family member, or how did you come to know about PTSD and how it affects people?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. PTSD, I don't personally suffer from that, but I was teaching college writing at Metro State University, which is a local university here in St. Paul for people that might be out of town. And I had quite a few veterans from the wars actually that were students of mine in my writing classes. And we would have memoir assignments, and I encouraged some of them to, you know, use their memoir assignments as sort of something therapeutic for them to write about their experiences, to maybe help, you know, transform their relationship to negative experiences by putting them on the page. So during that time when I was teaching some of those students, I actually have two of them that I think at the back of the book that I sat down with and talked extensively with about PTSD. And that really helped me just understand things a lot. One of the men that I talked to was Samuel Verdeja. He was one of my students. And he explained to me, because I didn't really understand it, because you can't really understand it unless you're experiencing it, I guess. But he explained a lot about how just hearing fireworks or something like that could put somebody right back in that scene where they feel like they're in the war zone again. So I did incorporate that in the story in one of the scenes with Sam, who is a recent veteran of Afghanistan who's just returned. So he's just a young man that Jesse, our main character, talks with during the story. And she actually sees him go through one of these episodes and tries to be there for him and, you know, show him kindness and empathy.
And how did you write about Afghanistan and PTSD and also the mom being deployed in Afghanistan? How did you write that all from a 10-year-old point of view?
Oh, that's a great question. Point of view is always just such a challenging thing. And I've been writing for, you know, writing forever, but like, writing seriously since 2003, and I started this book in 2007. One of the things that I think is very challenging about writing is the point of view. So the question is like, whose story is this? You know, there's multiple characters in here. You could say it's the dog story, or you'd say it's the veteran story, or, you know, whose is it? But I chose that this book is Jessie's story, and her mom is deployed in Afghanistan during the story. And so the question is, okay, are you going to write this in first person or, you know, third person point of view, that type mm-hmm. of thing? I decided to put it in first person, and that I would have it be from Jessie's point of view instead of an omniscient narrator. So we can only know what Jessie sees, and she's in every scene. And basically, it has to be authentic to what she would notice. So when you're thinking about a point of view character, you can think about, like, okay, well, what would she notice? Like, it's not going to be the same things that an adult would notice or think about. So it's really a trick to try to stay in that point of view, and you really have to put yourself inside the character. And then you really want your readers to be able to feel that too, like they're experiencing this through that character. And then they get to go along on her journey.
We'll talk more about that in a second. What prompted the, so you've talked a little bit about this already, but what prompted the puppy mill topic for the book, and again, some of Jessie's reaction, I don't know, I don't want to give anything away, so I'll rely on you to give away what you want to give away, but, you know, her reaction to it and what happens, how did the puppy mill thing come up, and how did you research that? I mean, who did you go to, and how did you find out more about that?
Yeah, that's a great question, and so it's like, what are puppy mills? They're literally like something that they're manufacturing dogs, like their own assembly line. So they breed dogs. So a dog mama could have many litters of pups. And the sad thing is that she has to say goodbye to each litter, you know, and often sooner than the pups should be taken away from their mom. And a difference between a puppy mill and a legitimate breeder is that puppy mills are not treating the dogs well, and they often live in overcrowded conditions surrounded by filth and malnourishment, and they're being abused. And once the dog's life is expended, and it's no longer useful to the mill and can't, you know, birth any more puppies, the dog is usually destroyed. So I wanted us to come in, like, who doesn't want to save somebody from that? But like, I wanted us to come into the story and have Jessie, you know, happen upon this dog who is in this circumstance and is about to, you know, be destroyed. That's where we come into the story. Jessie overhears that, and then she has to decide in the moment if she's going to do something or not, you know, and that's kind of one of the things about where she learns to be fearless, you know, is what do we do in these moments when our character is tested or we have to make a decision about how we're going to act. So she chooses to act, and that's pretty early in the story, but then she has to, you know, deal with the dog after that, which does present up quite a few challenges as well.
So that's kind of humorous with hiding the dog in the den and so on. And grandpa, you know, kind of knowing what's going on without revealing that to her. You know, it's kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of a thing. How do you feel the two fit together? I mean, they definitely fit together in my mind, and I'm just curious if that was a conscious decision to how to fit the two together, or if it just kind of happened that way.
Sure. Do you mean Jessie and the puppy mills, or
the PTSD and the puppy mill? And Jessie, she feels kind of guilty. She thinks she stole the dog. And so just kind of the feelings that are rolling around in the book. And also, I'd have to say some people, I don't think this, but some people might think these two topics are a little too serious for a young adult. I don't believe that, and I'm wondering, you know, how you feel about bringing these topics up to young adults and young adult, you know, fiction in general, bringing up serious topics in young adult fiction.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that and asking me about that. I mean, okay, so here's one of the challenges. Like, I really care about all these topics, but then, you know, you have this other challenge of like, well, some kids love to read and some are reluctant readers and all those types of things. So like, how would you get somebody to actually want to read about these topics? Well, there are many famous dog stories, so of course that is something that interests a kid.
Oh, sure.
But I think, yeah, I think one of the bigger things was learning how to bring in some humor into the story. And I've been told by young readers that are like 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, that's kind of the sweet spot, even though I've had a lot of people even older reading the book, such as one reviewer, it was kind of funny, who put an Amazon review out, Tom in Minneapolis. He said, "I think this is great. And I'm 75. So it's kind of funny, but it's like, you get like all these different range of ages. But for the young readers, where this is considered middle grade, so technically, so to be ages 8 to 12, mm-hmm. And that's really for marketers, so bookstores know where to put it on their shelves. But really, any age could read middle grade or young adult books. So as far as the learning or somebody liking to read about serious topics, I've actually found that the kids really love this story, and it's like an adventure story. So they really want to see what's going to happen. And I think that's really up to the writer to keep people turning the pages. I mean, we've all bought books that we set aside, you know, and it's like, gee, I spent $28 on that book or whatever, and I don't feel like finishing it. So one of my challenges here was, hey, I want to write something people don't want to put down. I've had a lot of adults read this also and say, hey, I read this in 2 days, and I stayed up late to read it, and I want to keep reading it. And, you know, kids who've said, hey, I didn't want it to end. That was a great one. But I think just, you know, you can introduce serious topics. Kids understand that there is, you know, dark things in the world going on. But again, then like, what will they actually care about? Well, you know, they do care about people, you know, as Jesse showed us in the book here, just all of the empathy and kindness she showed to Sam, that young veteran who has a PTSD incident in the story related to fireworks going off. You know, so that I feel rings true. So they care about people, and they know what kindness is. Kids know what, when things are unfair. They understand all those things, and they deal with them every day in friendships and school. And actually, it's really interesting that you asked that too, because I just listened to a podcast today. It was a New York Times podcast called The Daily, and they were talking about mental illness and PTSD in adolescents.
Mm.
And I really feel like, you know, if we had more stories like this, or people reading more things like this and getting more conversations going, it would actually help things more and help people bring issues to the surface and talk about them. So, I mean, when I write, I do like to write about things that have substance, but I've also been told by kids, like, their favorite character is actually Mickey, because he's funny, you know, he adds some levity. And that is something that's one of the reasons I added that character into the book too. So I think you have to have a balance, you know, like how are you going to keep the adventure going and interest, and just balance the different elements in the story. But I think you can have one that has a lot of substance like this. And I mean, one of the goals that I have in my writing is to write about things that are going to resonate after the story is done. So I'm hoping, you know, like you read this, I'm hoping you'll remember what it's about in a month or a year, or think about something in it, and that it'll resonate with you and other readers.
Talk about some of your other books. You've published quite a few books, the Day of Disaster series and some other things. Tell us about those so we can find them.
Oh, sure. Thank you. Yeah, those books. So Fearless is my first trade paperback that I did as where it was my own idea from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
The other, I've got 9 other books for kids published, and those are books where I wrote them on contract with the publishers. They're all available either through the publishers, Lerner Publishing or Abdo Publishing. Lerner is a local publisher down in downtown Minneapolis. And they're available through their website, you know, or through Amazon or a lot of other bookstores online. And they're available in school libraries and things like that too. And I really enjoyed working on all those series. And it's such a great training ground to work with editors and work on deadlines and things like that.
Were they all young adult?
Three of them are picture books,
mm-hmm.
in this Character Matters series. And then, so that would be ages like 4 to 8, thereabouts. Three of them are in the Day of Disaster series. And each of those focuses on a natural disaster that could really occur. And we're even seeing a lot of these types of things, but they go back many, many years as well. So I wrote about, those are really fun. They're the size of those are 15,000 words each. And so they're shorter than Fearless. Fearless, I think, is about 40,000 words. But the Day of Disaster books, one is about a blizzard that happens in northern Minnesota. Of course, I had to set it here. and that one has a dog in it as well. And then one is set in Hawaii, and it's called Wall of Water. And that has to do with a tsunami. And then the other one is called Black Blizzard, and that is a dust storm that overtakes a school bus when some students from a speech tournament are coming back from the tournament.
Oh.
Yeah, and then the other 3 books that I have published are 3 young adult research books. So those ones are nonfiction. Those were very, very extensively researched. One is on the Endurance Expedition, which is the Ernest Shackleton, who did the last polar Antarctic exploration. And that was right at the start of World War I. And then the other second one was the Orphan Train Movement. So that was very interesting. And there have been fiction books written about that as well. So I think people are familiar with that now. Also very fascinating. And then I did a biography of Ho Chi Minh, the North Vietnamese president. And that was incredibly complicated because I was interested in it because over his 70-year lifetime, that included the Vietnam War. And I wanted to learn more about that because I knew it was very complicated and, you know, just was kind of curious about it. And it was, it was just a very, very challenging project, but fascinating too. So those are the 9 books that I published before Fearless.
We are sadly coming up on the end. I think I have time for a couple more questions if we're brief about them. You, in your acknowledgments, you talk about writing groups. Why don't you tell us what writing groups have meant to you and why they're important?
Thank you. I think they're incredibly important. I started in a writing group in Eagan at the library, which I think still I think the group is still meeting. It's every Saturday morning. It's an open group, so anybody can go to it. And I think being in a weekly group, that was really good because it helped me form my habit of writing. So every week I'd have to bring something. So, and that is a lot of writing. It's just like, when are you going to get the words down on the page? How consistent can you be? And just getting things done. Over the years, I've been in a few different writing groups that have formed out of classes that I've taken at the Loft, for example. And those have just been invaluable. And just the relationships, the writing friendships that I've made over the years, you know, talk about the journey, not the destination. I mean, that's really a lot of what I've gotten out of this over the many years that I've been writing, is just the close friendships that I've made with people. And I'm currently in a group that meets weekly again. And I do think that that consistent, having a consistent time where you can, and place where you can bring your work and get feedback is really helpful. And just having an audience for your work is really important, I think. There are some writers who do not ascribe to this and they just write on their own until they send things into their editor. But I really think that's probably more the exception. For me personally, I like to have a group that I'm working with.
Well, we've been speaking with Kristen F. Johnson, author of Fearless, a young adult novel about a girl and a dog. Briefly, it's much more serious than that, but that's a good way to put it. Very, very briefly, what's next?
Oh, thank you. I am working on another middle grade novel that is set post-World War II, that's based on an incident that happened in my family back then, and when my mom was living in St. Paul. So I'm working on that right now. And so in addition to that, I'm just promoting Fearless and working on a lot of different projects. My wife, Elisa, actually is upstairs listening to this, and I appreciate all of her support throughout all of my writing endeavors. And she said something about Fearless earlier today that I thought was really cool. She said, I think it's about a girl who meets a canine friend and finds her purpose. I was like, oh my gosh, how did you summarize that? Because the book is so complicated, I think I have trouble like saying what it's about, you know? So I really appreciated that she came up with that. So I'm just doing a lot of events. Is it okay if I just mention where people can find the book?
Well, actually, we're running out of time. I've got my next people out front in. I'll let you go for now. We've been speaking with Kristen F. Johnson, author of Fearless. Thank you so much for coming tonight.
Oh, thank you, Liz. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, and now this.
Come join KFAI live at the State Fair on Labor Day, Monday, September 5th.